You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Trump is being criticized after a series of racist tweets aimed at progressive first-term congresswomen believed to be Representatives Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Ilhan Omar. Trump tweeted that the group came from other countries and should, quote, go back and help the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, end quote. All four representatives are U.S. citizens. Three were born in the country. The congresswoman responded at a press conference yesterday. Here's a listen to Representative Omar talking about Trump's rhetoric.
He's launching a blatantly racist attack on four duly elected members of the United States of House of Representatives, all of whom are women of color. This is the agenda of white nationalists, whether it is happening in chat rooms or it's happening on national TV, and now it's reached the White House garden.
Here's President Trump talking to reporters on the White House lawn earlier today.
And all I'm saying that if they're not happy here, they can leave. They can leave, and you know what? I'm sure that there'll be many people that won't miss them. But they have to love our country. They're congresspeople, and I never used any names. But these are people, quiet.
Jennifer Murcia is an associate professor at Texas A&M University. She's an expert in the history of American political discourse and author of the book Founding Fictions. Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
That's my pleasure.
You've been following President Trump and his language since the campaign. What do you make of some of the latest developments and what we've seen from these tweets and now this back and forth response?
Yeah, it's very consistent with what we saw during the 2016 election and the 2018 election. Trump is very comfortable pushing those racial buttons. He knows what riles up his base. He knows what will antagonize his opposition. And he's very comfortable in pushing those buttons, and he does it routinely.
And let's talk about the go back to your country as a part of American history. This isn't the first time this has been directed at people of immigrant background in their generation or in the generation or two before they came.
Oh, absolutely. There's a long history in our nation of not accepting new immigrants. Every time there's a new wave of immigrant migration, you know, there's always backlash. And so there's just a long history in this country of not living up to the ideals that we promise, right, in the Declaration of Independence.
You've written in the past about how the president's language is received, not in the mainstream or from his opponents, but from white nationalist organizations and people on white nationalist websites. What do you see there?
Yeah, this is what I found really fascinating about what happened sort of below the surface during the 2016 election. Almost immediately when Trump announced his campaign, white nationalists took an interest in him. They took an interest in the things that he was saying about immigration in particular. And they decided pretty quickly, at least some of them did, that they were going to support his campaign. Other white nationalist groups were debating whether or not Trump was truly one of them. And eventually they decided that because of two things that Trump had said in the past and that he was saying still during the campaign, that he was one of them. One is his racehorse theory of genetics. He is on record. You can Google this. I'm sure you don't have it ready to go for your listeners right now, but they can Google him and his racehorse theory, and they'll find lots of evidence of him saying that he comes from superior genes and that he believes that he has passed those superior genes on to his children and that he's a part of a superior race. So white nationalists like that. And then the other thing that they really liked about Trump in 2016 was that they thought that he was on the right side of what they called the nationalism question, which is that they heard Trump saying that white people deserve their own nation and that he was going to purify the nation for them, right? So these are people who hear the word diversity and they call that white genocide. They think that that's polluting or destroying the white race. They believe themselves to be in a race war already, and they saw Trump as someone who was either already on their side or someone who they could use sort of as a stooge in some ways to get their message out.
Talking to Jennifer Mercia, associate professor at Texas A&M University, about President Trump's Twitter and then out loud comments about members of Congress, women of color. And Jennifer, the argument from the president and some in the White House, including Kellyanne Conway and the president's supporters, is that this wasn't about race. This was about the patriotism and love of country that he says should be exhibited by members of Congress. Is that a fair defense?
Well, you know, so it's an interesting thing. America is an idea, and there isn't one person who gets to define what America means or who is American. So certainly not just the president. That's a conversation that we all have together. And Donald Trump was someone who was very critical of the government when he was not in charge of it. Right. But it is true that to be a patriot in this country, we often think of that as uncritical nationalism. Right. As just sort of agreeing with anything that the country does or the president might say. But the actual history of patriotism dating, you know, to the Revolutionary War meant that you were critical of the government, that you were someone who defended the ideals of the Constitution and eventually of the Declaration of Independence. So it meant that you defended the community against the government.
Is there something different in the age of social media and politics that make it more effective to have messages like those of the president? Do they travel better in the online world than they might have, say, 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. That's such a great question. Right. So all social media algorithms are designed to promote outrage. Right. So the more outrageous thing that you say or the president says or that I say, the more people will actually see that tweet. And of course, that will cause more outrage, which will cause more engagement. It's all designed to keep us attending to that network or that platform, so that we can be engaged. And the way they do that is obviously through emotion. So Trump is a master at playing this game. He is great at attracting attention. So what he did on Sunday with these tweets, I think that was no accident. Like I said before, I think he's very comfortable towing that sort of racism line. And he's certainly not afraid of it. And I think that he knew that he would get a lot of attention for it. And if you think about what we're not paying attention to over the last 3 days while we're, you know, wondering whether or not Trump is a racist, you know, there are a lot of other really important stories that make Trump look not so good. Roger Stone was in court today. Jeffrey Epstein was in court yesterday. We heard that WikiLeaks, Julian Assange was visited specifically in the Ecuadorian embassy, you know, and so there's all kinds of stories that are unfolding that we're maybe not paying enough attention to right now.
Talking to Jennifer Mercia, historian of American political discourse, about rhetoric on race and politics we're seeing after President Trump's recent tweets and comments aimed at Democratic congresswomen. Jennifer, there are concerns about declines in civility in American political life. We've had some rocky moments in the past, too. What do you see as the trends when it comes to whether we're able to have civil conversations even at the highest levels?
Yeah, that's a really interesting problem that we're having right now. I think that part of the outrage and attention economy makes it more difficult for us to have productive conversations. And I would use the word productive as opposed to civil, because what I think we're trying to do is to figure out ways to solve problems. Sometimes we might need to be uncivil in order to solve problems, right? Sometimes issues need to be raised and they need to be raised in a way that, you know, isn't polite, because sometimes people are excluded from those conversations. But that can still be productive. But the way that the attention economy works and the outrage industry, the fact that we have less face-to-face communication than we used to, that we have failed to join political organizations that help to teach us democratic deliberation and skills related to having productive conversations. Those are all bad for productive conversations that we could be having and should be having. So yeah, I'm actually very concerned about that.
Whose job is it to fix that?
Well, you know, I'm in a communication department, and there are communication departments at universities and community colleges around the country that teach citizenship skills through communication. We teach democratic deliberation, and it's a popular major. So we have a lot of students who are interested in these things. But yeah, I mean, in terms of how it works in the public sphere, you know, not all media is NPR, unfortunately. And, you know, cable news, it functions the same way the rest of the outrage and attention economy does. You know, it's all about putting emotive content and partisanship and polarization front and center, and it's not so interested in problem solving.
What could be done? Let's look at social media in particular. There are a lot of conversations going on about this in European governments, to some extent in the United States. Do there need to be regulations, or would you like to see the Twitters and YouTubes and whatnot to police themselves, regulate themselves better to not steer people to the outrage?
Well, so it's hard to know exactly what's going to solve the problem. We know that some of the problem exists because of the way that the algorithms are constructed, right? And so somebody like Tristan Harris will tell you that there are 1,000 engineers who spend all day, every day, trying to figure out more ways to get you addicted to your social media platforms, right? And that they're very good at it, right? They trigger the dopamine receptors in your brain, and they really addict you to the feedback that you get from posting outrageous content. But then, you know, on the other side of the coin, there are organizations like the Kettering Foundation that teaches people how to organize really productive civic dialogues in their communities. And anyone can learn to organize those kinds of conversations, and they can be used to solve problems. Part of the problem that we have right now is that we don't trust anyone to be a sort of neutral arbiter, either of truth or of our conversation, right? We don't trust the platforms. We don't trust news organizations, particularly if we think they're slanted from the other perspective. We don't trust political parties. We don't trust the opposition party. We don't trust the government. And so part of the breakdown in society right now is that we have this fundamental lack of trust. And so part of that is that we don't know who to trust to help us to organize our conversations to be more productive.
Let's bring on a caller now. Teresa is with us in Menominee Falls. Teresa, hi.
Yes, hi. My comment is I'm less concerned about the personal tweets that Trump gives to the congresswomen and other people in politics and the world. I'm more concerned about the exponential effect that it has on the United States and our citizens. So when somebody goes to Burger King and they're sitting there and hear somebody speaking Spanish, they consider it their right and okay and wonderful to torment, bully, and intimidate people who never asked for it, have no deserving of it. And so the congresswomen and the women of the legislative and political, they can roll with it. It's the common citizens that are traumatized.
Teresa, thanks. Don't have too much time left. Going to jump in. Jen, a trickle-down effect, she's saying, in effect, from the president's language.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a poll done by Pew this year where people said that since Trump was elected, 65% believe that it is more common for people to express racist or racially insensitive views. So I think that there is a great majority of people in this country that really believe that Trump has said these kinds of things in public. And so now it's okay that we all do that. You know, it's okay to be racist now.
Teresa,
it's a problem.
Thanks for your call. And just our last minute, Jen, what are you watching for now as we kick off this new presidential campaign?
I'm looking for someone to be able to hold Trump accountable, right? So part of the problem in 2016 was that Trump was an unaccountable leader. He was never held to account for any of the things that he said or did. Not by his party. The media had a hard time. Trump was able to play sort of journalistic norms against them. And he was so good for ratings that it was hard for them to combat, you know, what he was doing. And so I'm really interested to see in 2020 if there's any institution or organization that is able to sort of match Trump's power. He's a powerful rhetorician.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jennifer Mercia, historian of American political discourse at Texas A&M University. She was with us to talk about President Trump's rhetoric in the wake of recent tweets targeting four Democratic congresswomen.